All right, guys, what a pleasure I've got for you today. What a gift, a New Year's gift. I've got the great Maz Jobrani with me. I'll tell you how we met originally in a second, but let me tell you about some of the accolades of this guy. Founding member of the Axis of Evil comedy tour, which I'm sure you'll tell me about. He's appeared on The Tonight Show and many other high-profile venues. Author of a recent book, I think recently released, I'm Not a Terrorist, But I Played One on TV, Memoirs of a Middle Eastern Funny Man. And then acting credentials include appearances on Grey's Anatomy, Curb Your Enthusiasm, True Blood, and Shameless, and countless others. What a pleasure to have you, Maz. How you doing, man?
Good, Gad. How you doing, man?
It's great. So I'm so glad that we finally made it happen. We met just so that people can know how you our two worlds intersected. I'm just checking to make sure. Yeah, okay, it's recording. We met at Ciudad, I can't pronounce it, Ciudad de las Ideas. It's sort of the equivalent of TED in Latin America. It was held in Mexico. And I think we looked at each other. There was kind of complicity right away. Am I right?
We hit it off, man. We hit it off. We started talking. I was like, this guy, I like how he thinks. And then you mentioned Joe Rogan, who is a
That's
mutual
true.
friend.
That's
And then
true.
after that, it was just this, man.
Boom.
This.
Boom.
Boom.
And then I find out now that you're friends with Marin. Is that am I pronouncing
Yeah.
his name correctly?
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
just discovered well discovered him. I just found out about him recently on his very funny show. So wow, what cool stuff. So I thought we would start by talking about your stand-up comedy. We could both, of course, talk about the practice of stand-up comedy, but I might also have some interjections from a scientific perspective, how we study humor, and then we'll take it wherever we need to go. So
Absolutely.
start us off. I know that you were enrolled. Oh,
Excuse me.
bless you. Allah ikun ma'ak, may God be with you in Arabic.
Ah, yes.
You were enrolled in a PhD program in political science at UCLA and then dumped that gig to follow your dreams. Why don't you start there, maybe?
Yeah, this could have been a much different conversation we're having right now. I was born in Iran. I grew up in America. Since I was 6 years old, we left Iran at the revolution of 79. And then in America, when I was a kid, maybe 10 years old or so, I remember seeing Eddie Murphy. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I loved what he was doing. And then I started doing plays when I was 12 years old in school. And I fell in love with being on stage. So I would do these plays, and I was pretty good at it. And my parents, my Iranian parents, immigrant parents, they would come to the shows. First of all, they would come. It's funny because I grew up in Marin County, where everyone they're well off, but they're very casual. I always say they drive Volvos and
Right.
Saabs, even though they have the money. My parents, coming from Iran, my dad was like very ostentatious, and so they come, and my dad buys a Rolls Royce.
Wow.
We've always got a Mercedes at some point. I mean, it's just like very different cultures. So at these shows, people would show up kind of dressed when we do plays. In 7th and 8th grade, the parents would show up kind of, khakis and a nice shirt. My parents would dress up like they're going to the opera, like a suit and a fur coat. And it was just like they always stood out. But anyway, I would do a show, and then the director after the show would be telling my parents, who spoke decent English, but kind of not great English, but the director would say, your son's got potential. He could really do this as a in his future. And my parents would just sit there and smile very politely, thank you, thank you. Then in the car they'd be like, that lady, she's crazy, man. I'm like, what is she talking about? Am I allowed to cuss on this show, on this thing?
If you'd like.
I don't cuss much, but like, usually when I tell the story, I say, like, they'd be like, that bitch is crazy. Point being that, like, my parents were like, there's no way in hell that you're gonna pursue acting as a profession
They
and
want you to
comedy.
be an engineer, an accountant, a doctor, a lawyer, a
Absolutely.
professor.
Absolutely. And I
Yeah.
always tell people that, like, immigrant parents have a lot in common. They're like, it's like Jewish parents and like Persian parents and Indian parents. There's a lot they have in common, and that's what they want. So when it came time to go to college, I said, I want to study acting. My parents said, you should be a lawyer. And they convinced me that I should be a lawyer, and that if I wanted to do acting and comedy, I could just do it on the side as a hobby. So I went to UC Berkeley, studied political science undergrad, thinking that would then lead me to graduate school to be a lawyer. While I was at UCLA, I did 1 year. I'm sorry, while I was at UC Berkeley, undergrad, I did my junior year abroad in Italy. And while I was there, there was this professor. His name was Vincenzo Pace.
Aye.
This guy, Enzo Pace. And he had a goatee, had like kind of a beard like you, goatee, nice goatee.
But not as good looking.
Good looking, just like you, man.
Okay. All
right. And the guy had like this blazer he would wear, and he had like this like a gold pocket watch. Right. And every day before the class would start, he would take out the watch and he would give it a look, and then he would wait, and like as the seconds ticked down, he would close the watch and he'd go, allora, momento, or whatever it was, like, allora, momento means, okay, let's speak about Muhammad. It was sociology of religion. That's what the class was. Great class. So then I go, that's what I want to do. So that's when I came back to America and I told my parents that, listen, I'm actually not going to be a lawyer, I'm going to be a professor. And even with that, my mom was freaking out. She was like, what do you mean, professor? There's no work for professor. Like, what kind of future is that? And my mom had no idea what she was talking about, but she was like, I think she was caught up in this idea of, I always tell people, your parents want what they think is best for you.
Right.
So they think if you become a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer, you're going to have a good earning, you're going to have a nice hot life, and things will be great. They're not at all concerned with what might make you happy.
Right.
They just want that.
You don't have agency. They own you, right?
Absolutely. Right. And they want what they want security, right. You know, more than happiness. By the way, again, immigrants, like, it's like, happiness? What are you talking about? Nobody's happy. Just go to work.
You struggle through life.
Struggle.
It's misery.
We left a revolution. You want happiness? So then I went to UCLA to get the PhD in political science. And then while I was there, early on, I was like, the acting bug was just killing me. And I'm in my early 20s at this point. And I go, you know what? I just got to see what's going on at the theater department. So I go to the theater department. I audition. I get into their big play. And when I'm on stage, I just feel alive. And then when I would go into my PhD classes for poli sci, and we'd be discussing our purpose as political scientists. Like, why are we even doing this? And in the end, you know, a lot of times the discussions would end with the professor saying, you got to publish or perish.
Right.
And secondly, you may, if you're lucky, write something that a politician or somebody will use in a practical world. But otherwise, you're living in a theoretical world.
Right.
And it kind of turned me off. And so that's when I said, you know what? I'm not going to do this. And I dropped out. To then get back into acting and comedy of the sort, and then here we are many years later.
So let me jump in at several points. So a couple of my own personal stories. At one point, my mother, very, very similar story to yours, she was all upset that I was going to head down into academia because her vision of an academic was this kind of geeky, long-haired guy, which I had long hair. I still sort of do, wearing sandals, right? So it's sort of a guy who philosophizes, but otherwise, where's the money, right? And when I first became a professor and I would tell my parents, oh, you know, I'm going to give a talk. I was invited to give a talk at this university. What do you think is the first question they would ask subsequent to me saying this? Any guesses?
How much are they paying?
And then I would say, oh, no, this, I'm just going, you know, just as an honor to share my knowledge. And then you'd see them sort of shaking their heads in disbelief in terms of where have we gone wrong with this kid, you know?
Yeah.
But of course, eventually they sort of understood the value of it. The other story I want to share with you, I think I might have shared it once before in a public setting. When I finished my MBA, I mean, I always knew I was going to go in academia, but I thought, oh, maybe I'll take a break. I had a brother who lives in Southern California who was a very successful businessman. So I was thinking, you know, maybe we'd work together. He was interested in having me join him for a while before I went back to do my PhD. And when my mother caught wind at that point that I might not pursue my PhD, she took me to the side of another room at one point, and she looked at me very seriously and said, Gad, do you want people to remember you as somebody who dropped out of school? This was after I had an MBA. So there's really quite interesting dynamics when it comes to...
It's funny you say both of those things. First of all, the money thing is very interesting because now the world of academia, at least I think people everywhere around the world know what a professor is, what the professor does, right? And they have that image, like you said, of this philosophical guy maybe walking around doing this.
Right.
Who knows how much money he makes. They probably think not much. The parents think. Now, the world of acting and comedy is a completely different world where people that aren't in the business don't really know how it works that well. much less immigrant parents who aren't in the business. They have no idea, you know, from Iran to America, they don't know how any of this works. So it's funny that you say that, because as my career was starting to do better and better, and I was starting to end up on TV shows and touring and this and that, my father had moved back to Iran because he'd lost a lot of his money in America with bad real estate investments. So in the early 90s, right as I was mid-undergrad, so before all my decisions of changing careers and stuff, he'd moved back to Iran. So then I come back, I say I want to be a professor. My father, because professor is a doctor.
Of course.
So whereas my mother was a little worried about my future, my father out of Iran was still kind of like, oh, you're going to be a doctor, you're going to get your PhD.
That's good, yeah.
Yeah, and he would say things like, you know, once you finish your PhD, we can work together and, you know, whatever. Just like he's a businessman, so he thought in some capacity we can work together. Right. Now, once I dropped out, it's funny because then my father, again, he was so far away, he didn't really have as much control. So he would say things like, you know, listen, when you go back and you finish your PhD, then we can, like, he still was kind of in denial that I was pursuing this acting thing. He probably thought it was like a hobby or something. But the funny thing is, so then my career started to take off and all this stuff. And then my father had to come back to the U.S. Because of medical reasons. And he still had no idea really how this works. Whereas my mother had been able to come to some of my stand-up comedy shows, she'd seen me on TV. She'd come to shows and seen people laugh and had people say, oh, I enjoy your son. So she was kind of in it. My father hadn't had any of that. And by the time he came here, he was a little more sick, so he wasn't able to really come to any of my shows. So he had no idea really how this all worked. And he came to the U.S., he had this medical procedure done, and then he had to go back to Iran. And before he went back to Iran, I ended up booking a TV show where I was going to be a regular on the show and get paid pretty well. And I first told my dad, I said, hey, Dad, you know, by the way, I just got this show. I got this gig on a show on ABC. And my dad, you know, he's trying to be nice, but he's like, oh, yes, that's good. You know, like he doesn't know what ABC is, CBS. Right. He doesn't know the networks. He's like, yeah, good. And then I go, Dad, I'm going to be a regular on this. She's like, And then I was like, Dad, they're going to pay me. And I was like, whatever the amount was, this much a week. He's like, oh,
that's very good.
He finally understood. He's like, you're getting paid?
there's a very similar story. This is not my story, and I want to also tie it to a couple of other things. George Michael, the famous singer, yeah. I saw a documentary of his a few years ago where I think the story was very similar to yours, where, you know, the dad was very, very disappointed that this guy was pursuing music and was going to be a singer. And apparently he had already become, you know, a gigantic superstar. I mean, the guy is playing in front of, I don't know, 100,000 people. And then his dad he finally came to a concert where he saw some huge crowd, like let's say at Wembley Stadium, who are there to watch his son sing. And it's that level of stimulus that allowed him to sort of understand what his son did. So you really see the disconnect sometimes between what the parents think and what the children are doing. But two other quick stories. You know, you're talking about performance. And in a sense, I mean, to be a professor is to also engage in a performance, right? I mean, sure. I mean, you're getting up there and your goal is to impart happiness and make people laugh and so on. And my goal is to, you know, hopefully share some interesting knowledge that will make people think twice. I may lace it with some jokes. And so in a sense, we're both engaging, albeit using different currency, in a performance. Now, Joe Rogan, our mutual friend, and I think I had mentioned this to you in Mexico, had on my first appearance on the show, he had mentioned something that was, I thought, very poignant. He said that, you know, unlike actors, where it's kind of a fuzzy metric of success, when you're in stand-up comedy, or when you are an MMA fighter, since that's also part of his world, or you're a professor, the metrics by which people judge you are very clear. I mean, if I get up and I say bullshit, people are going to call me on it. If you get up and you're not funny, you're going to get that feedback. If you go to the ring and you're not prepared, someone's going to beat you up. So that's another commonality. In other words, you can't fake the jobs that we're doing. people are going to find you out if you're not up to standards, right?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, it's funny because I think the part of the PhD that it interested me, the part of the teaching that it interested me was the performance part. Because when I saw Enzo Pace and how passionate he was, and he got to stand in front of us and talk about these issues every day, I thought, wow, that's cool. And in all honesty, it's funny because I still have an affinity towards, like, I think that's one of the reasons why I hit it off with you, because when we would be talking and you would talk about some psychological thing that you had studied or you were talking about one of your studies or something that you knew about, I really was into it because we're talking about these ideas, and I still love being able to sit in a room with a bunch of people and discuss all these different ideas.
Right.
So that part of it I really loved. And it was the other part of it, the publisher Parrish, which I was like, I don't want to sit down and have to write these books and the sort. But you're right. We do instantly, you do get that instant feedback. They will let you know if you're good or you're bad. And maybe there's, I don't know, like the psychology of why do I have to be, is it my enjoyment of the ideas? But also the question becomes, why is it me? I have this feeling of standing in front of an audience, whether it's as a professor or as a comedian. I have no idea what that is. I don't, you know.
Yeah, that I'm going to have to charge you for someone to answer those questions.
Yeah.
But actually, that leads us to an interesting sort of segue. The fact that you're so interested in speaking about ideas that have nothing to do with your career speaks to something that in academic study of humor is relevant to what you said. So it turns out that when women say, I want to go out with a guy who makes me laugh. Sense of humor is really important to me, right? So as an evolutionary psychologist who, of course, studies mating preferences, I can attest to the fact that they're not just BSing us, right? I mean, they genuinely, truly want a guy that's funny. And here's where I link it back to your pursuit of intellectual issues. Because sense of humor is a proxy measure of intelligence, right? I mean, it's very, very difficult for somebody to be astute in a funny way, observationally funny, sarcastic, witty, and yet he's dull as a knife. I mean, he's stupid as a dull knife, right? I mean, so when you get up and you're able to maintain our attention because you are tying all sorts of observations in the world in a funny way, you're actually advertising that I'm a smart guy. And so it doesn't surprise me that you've got these intellectual interests, because ultimately, if you're a successful comedian, it's likely that you're a smart guy. So,
well, it's funny what you're saying, because I personally feel that, like, I think we all have strengths. I remember reading a book years ago. I forget. I think it was called The Seven Types of Intelligence or something.
Oh, and Howard Gardner.
Yeah. And it was one of these things where it was encouraging people to go, just because you don't get straight A's doesn't mean you're dumb. Maybe you're artistically smart. Maybe you're performance-wise smart. I personally think that I have the performance smarts,
right?
In that ever since I started doing the plays and stuff, I remember a friend of mine used to tell me how he loved acting, but he was saying that, like, hitting his mark or like trying to hit his mark, like, or thinking while he's walking and thinking about his lines threw him off. Whereas I, from the start, I felt natural on stage and it all just came together. There's some sort of coordination that goes from my brain to my body that performance-wise, I've always been very confident about.
Are you eating? I'm sorry, go ahead.
The thing that I've had to grow as a comedian is, I believe, in the other part of the writing. Like, there's some comedians who are really smart writers. I even have friends. There's a friend of mine. One of them is a cardiothoracic surgeon. One of them is a lawyer. Another one has his own business. And then there's another lawyer. These friends of mine from college, from UC Berkeley, a couple of them are super funny. And I've told both of them, I said, if you were not doing surgery, you could be a comedy writer. Like, when we're all just joking around, they come up with so many funny things where sometimes as a comedian, I'm like, oh, I wish I would have come up with that. So they have that kind of humor and intelligence, but they are not performers.
They can't deliver it in the public setting.
Or they can't stand on stage and be comfortable delivering it. Whereas I'm craving that, you know?
Right.
So I feel like what you're saying, I think there's some truth to it, but I also think you can analyze the different types of intelligence in being humorous.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? There's the cerebral guy, there's the guy who's a great performer, and we could talk about different, sure, you know, like Eddie Murphy is an amazing performer.
Right.
That when he was doing his stand-up, he had all the characters and telling the stories. Now, I know a lot of that stuff came from his life. I'm not sure how much of that stuff, I'm not sure how many of the punchlines he wrote.
Right.
Probably a lot, but I'm sure he had other people helping him.
Right.
And that's those guys who can't be on stage doing it as well as Eddie Murphy was, but they can look at Eddie Murphy and go, hey, when you talk about the barbecue, you should add this punchline, this punchline, this punchline.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, so let me ask you this, and I hope, because you're in the business, so there's no cost for me to denigrate a comedian, but maybe there's a cost for you, and this is a very famous one.
Yeah.
Yesterday on Colbert, whatever the new show is called, but the Colbert Show, he had Jerry Seinfeld on. Now, I, of course, like most people who live on Earth, I loved the Seinfeld show, but even when he had his little shtick at the start of the early Seinfelds, the monologues,
yeah,
I didn't find them funny then. And whenever I've seen him, I've actually found him to be quite tedious. And when I watched it yesterday, I was pained. I had to turn the station because I simply did not find it funny. Whereas someone like Louis C.K.,
yeah,
his sharpness, his sort of cutting humor, I find it really, now maybe it's just a personal style, but
so,
what do you think of what I just said as a professional comedian?
Was Seinfeld doing stand-up?
Or he was doing stand-up. Okay. I thought it, if I may use a colloquialism, it sucked beyond belief.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny because, first of all, stand-up is very subjective.
Okay.
And I've had to accept that as a comedian because sometimes I've gone online and read the comments under my clips and thought, oh my God, they hate me. But then I go, wait a minute, there's enough people that like me,
right,
that I'm making a career and that's what matters.
Right.
And more importantly, what matters is you have to talk about what makes you laugh. Now, I personally have watched Seinfeld do stand-up, and I'm entertained by it. I think it's funny. And the difference is, like, for me, people go, who's your influences and stuff? And I always say, like, Richard Pryor for me.
Okay.
It was originally Eddie Murphy, but then later I like what Richard Pryor was
doing. Why? So tell us, can you break that down?
Well, yeah.
What is it in your – yeah, go ahead.
Because Carlin and Pryor and these guys were also doing social commentary. There was a message in there.
Okay.
So that really – excited me. And then when I started doing stand-up as a Middle Eastern American, I tried to put some messages into my stand-up because I feel like, you know, there's a famous line in the Public Enemy song. It says, F the game if it ain't saying nothing. They say the actual word, but F the game if it ain't saying nothing. So if you're not saying anything, then what's the point?
Right.
So that's why those are the guys that I've, like, even to this day, like, I love watching Louis Black lose his mind on TV.
Right.
Because I think it's hilarious. Or even Daily Show, there's a lot of commentary. Those things I really enjoy. Now, Seinfeld was never at the top of my list of those are the guys that inspired me. But I do remember watching him and always thinking he's funny. And then more recently, this is what's funny to me. More recently when I've seen him, he has done, I think, some more social commentary that I was going like, oh, snap, like Jerry Seinfeld is going there. So I've always enjoyed him. But like you said, it's so subjective. I mean, just last night I did two shows, okay? One at the Laugh Factory, one at the Improv. First show, Laugh Factory, smaller audience. But an audience that right off the bat when I went up there, there was a group of Saudi kids who had brought me to Penn State last year. There's a big Saudi Arabian contingency at Penn State.
Wow.
So they hired me to perform there last year, and I guess they were here on their Christmas break, on the holidays, you know, and they had come to the show. So there was like 10 Saudis right there. There was a handful of Persians who'd seen me in like an hour south from LA. They'd shown up. And it was just like once I went on stage, like these guys were there to see me. And right off the bat, they gave me such warmth. I didn't know who they were at first. I was like, who are you guys? I started talking to them, and they're like, Penn State, Saudi Arabia. I'm like, hey, I know you guys. And then, you know, and then the Persian was like, Palos Verdes. And then it was the funny thing was, now just to show you how it all comes together, small crowd, maybe 40 people. But I had the Saudis here screaming, and I'm like, take it easy. And I like started joking about like, you know, like people are going to think you're ISIS and this and that. And I'm not kidding. I looked to my left And there's this kind of round white guy who had like a military fatigue top. And I go, and we got the Oregon
militia.
Yeah, they're here. The separatists are here too. So it was perfect. I was like, we got ISIS over here, the separatists over there. And it just gelled, right? So that show became this electric show where I felt, and this is where the subjectiveness comes, I felt like I could do my material, I could talk about anything, and the crowd was going to go with me. And they did. The next show at the Improv, I showed up, and there were a younger audience. And by the time I got up, they'd seen a few, like I followed Judd Apatow, and then right before him was this other guy who just is on Saturday Night Live now, a young guy who killed. He was high energy, it was amazing. So by the time I got up, the energy of the crowd already was starting to die down. And it didn't feel, I still did fine, but it was not, and it was a packed room, by the way.
And it's the same material you're delivering, right?
Very similar material. And at times though, because I'm kind of off my game a little bit, I'm kind of misplacing some of the jokes as I'm going, because I'm like, oh wait, that was supposed to be there. So the point I'm trying to make to you is, subjectively speaking, someone might have seen me last night at the second show and been like, this guy sucks. And see me at the first show and be like, this guy is the next Richard Pryor. So there's that subjectivity of comedy. And that's where, as a comedian, what becomes hard is when you start, and it's an instinct. You're like, you really want everyone to like you. You really want everyone to laugh.
Right.
And when you start worrying about that is when you're in trouble, because you start sweating and you're swimming upstream, you know. Whereas if you could turn that thing off, which I'm sure a guy like Jerry Seinfeld has had to, or I know a guy who's great at doing this is Andrew Dice Clay.
Right.
Andrew Dice Clay, his whole act is about, like, I don't care about you. Like, right. That's the whole act. So if he has so much confidence that he can go on stage and do that, and even maybe go and do an hour of bombing and not worry about it, you know, or at least act like he's not worrying about it, but, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there... Yeah. That's where you're going, like, this is who I am, and I've accepted the fact that not everyone's going to love me. And I think a guy like Seinfeld has had to do that, because once you're that big, you have to know there's a, you know, Gad Saad at his house cringing. Meanwhile, there's, you know.
And I don't think he cares, though.
I don't think he cares. Yeah,
no, I don't think. Yeah. But now, when you're doing the start of the show and you're picking up the vibes, either from the crowd's feedback or from your delivery or both, that this is not going well, that voice of doubt, if it creeps in live while you're doing it, has it ever taken you to sort of a catastrophic place where you sort of not break down, but where you just pull a blank, where, or have you always been able to retrieve it and get back on track?
No, you know, the hardest part is when you feel that, okay, this is not going how it's supposed to be going, and they're just not on board with this stuff. And then my instinct is, having done this now for like 17 years, going on 18 soon, is that my instinct is I've learned to talk to the audience. So then I try to go to the audience.
Okay.
Now, if you go to the audience and you're still not getting anything, that's when you're like, oh man, this is going to be tough. And you do, you start sweating. There's been times where I've just, like, you know, I've come off drenched because that nervousness is causing it, I think. There was one time in Dubai. First of all, let me tell you, the best is when you end up on a show that a lot of people don't know you, and you go up and you surprise them.
Right.
And they go, wow, who's this guy? Why haven't I heard this guy? And I've had shows like that, and I felt great about it. I've been like, oh, see? I was like, see, even though they're not my audience, my jokes work, and I should be as known as Seinfeld, because I can cross everybody. Everybody understands me. Then there's the opposite, which is when you end up on an event that people know you. Now, not shows of your own. Like, when I do my own shows, where people have bought tickets to come see my shows, for the most part, they're excited. They've spent money. They're ready to eat. They know me, but they're ready to go.
So you're thinking now corporate events.
Corporate events, right. Or if an organization hires you and says, hey, we want to do a show with you. Oh, we love you. I've had a couple of those where we showed up, and for whatever reason, it just didn't gel, you know. And then when it's your, when it's supposed to be a home court advantage, it's supposed to be that you're playing at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, and you're here, and people aren't laughing. So I had that one time in L.A. where I took myself and another friend of mine, who's very funny, this guy Sebastian Maniscalco, who is now really blowing up. He and I did a show. There was, I think it was a Persian Jewish organization that knew me. And they were like, we love you. We want you to come. We want you to come. And we go there. And for whatever reason, this crowd, I was watching Sebastian, who at the time was already very funny. And he wasn't getting any laughs. And I thought, you know what? Maybe they just don't understand his humor. But this is my fan base. Right. They're going to love me. Well, I go up and I'm not getting much either. And it just like becomes a half an hour of torture as you're going, what is wrong? Like, am I doing the lines wrong? What's going on? And even they, I think, sometimes are shocked because they've seen you on YouTube or whatever and thought it was very funny. Right. And now live, it's just not happening. And one of the times that was really bad was this event in Dubai where it was like a big art event. It was an opening for their art week. And this lady had hired me and it was a big, you know, they'd spent a lot of money and they had huge art. They were going to do an auction and they brought in dancers and chefs and all this other stuff. And it was amazing because the other thing that people don't know is, and this goes a little bit to you as well, is the setup of how and when you see comedy is very important.
Right.
So you don't want to see, like, there's a reason why stand-up comedy shows usually last about an hour and a half. You don't want to do an event and say in the fourth hour of an evening, put up a stand-up comedian. People are exhausted. No one's paying attention, okay? So the same thing for you. Like, you're sitting there watching Seinfeld at home. You're like, I don't know. But I have a good friend of mine, this guy, Omid Jalili, who's a Iranian comedian out of England, who told me when he went to see, when Seinfeld went to England and did the O2 Center in front of 16,000 people, Omid went to see him and he said, it was the most amazing thing because he goes, there was all this traffic to get into the show. And he goes there and he's watching and he goes, Seinfeld in the beginning does like 5 minutes or something about how hard it was to get into the place.
Right.
And he goes, right away, people loved him.
Right.
And it was brilliant. So maybe if you'd been there that night with 16,000 people who'd gone through traffic and now he's talking your language, you would have been like, right. Oh, man. I was wrong. So with that, so then I'm in Dubai and I show up at this art event and everybody before the event is coming up going like, oh my God, huge fan. You know, I've always wanted to see you live. These people have all paid like $200, $300 a ticket just to come to this event. They sit down. The evening starts with, they bring out this like dance troupe that does like a half an hour Michael Jackson thing where they're like hanging upside down. It was amazing. I'm sitting there watching these guys going, wow.
I have to follow these guys.
Yeah, I'm like, I got to follow these guys. Well, not only do I have to follow these guys, but once that finishes, then they have a lady come and talk about the organization. Then they have a testimonial about another lady who says, if it wasn't for this organization, my kids would be dead. So now people are sad. Then they have an auction where the auctioneer comes out. This guy, Johnny Gould, who is a British auctioneer, who's great. He's funny, he's charming, and he was killing it. And he does like a half an hour, 45-minute auction where people are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on art, but he's funny. And as I'm watching him, after I've seen the dancers, I've seen the speakers, now I'm watching Johnny, and he's a funny auctioneer, I'm thinking to myself, they don't need me. They should have just finished with him. Why'd they bring me? Like, he's killing it.
Right.
Then after that, they bring out a chef who brings out a crew of other cooks, a German chef. He brings out all of his cooks who are going to help him make dessert at your table. So now you got a German chef screaming like, you know, pull the sugar! And they're pulling the sugar. Pull the dinner! And everyone's like, whoa. And then the dessert comes. It's delicious. We're like 4 hours into this night. And I'm just sitting there going like, man, I got to get them somehow. And this is, again, it should be my home crowd because right. It's Dubai. They know me. There's Lebanese, there's Persians, there's Indians, there's Kuwaitis, and I have material about all these people. And I'm sitting waiting. And after all of this, I kid you not, like we started the night at 7, it's like 11-ish now. And the damn DJ, he goes, please welcome Maz Jobrani. And I'm like, that's it? That's all I get? And I have to walk up there to what was supposed to be an easy crowd, and I start doing my material, I'm getting nothing. I'm getting nothing. I start doing crowd work, and the crowd work really isn't going anywhere. And I'm telling you, I was supposed to do like 20 minutes, but I think I did like 40 because I kept looking for something.
To connect with them.
It's like trying to start a fire. I'm trying to start, if not starting. And I came down and I felt the back of my suit was just drenched because I was up there just sweating bullets.
So two things. So what you just talked about in terms of whether you go up and you're successful or not, I had a postdoc a post-PhD who came to work under my tutelage last year, and his original area of research in his PhD was to study the evolutionary roots of humor. Now, he was coming to study under my supervision in the stuff that I do, which is the evolutionary roots of consumer behavior. But at one point, we had thought about doing a project because we have here the Laugh Fest. What is it? The Laugh Festival?
Just
for laughs and so on. Because we have this opportunity, and since I do work with testosterone, we thought of joining the two, whereby we would measure comedians' testosterone levels before they go on stage, and then after they go on stage. And then, of course, the hypothesis would have been that, you know, if you've done very well, hence you've gotten a social win, then your testosterone would go up. But had you been beaten up in the way that you were in the last story, then your tail is going to be between your legs and your testosterone is going to be down. If anybody's watching the show, you can't steal this hypothesis because I've said it in public. It's mine.
That's great.
But anyways, we never ended up doing it. He's now moved on. I think he's in Wales as a professor. But yeah, so there are very, very cool things you could study with in terms of humor. I wanted to say a second thing, but I can't remember now. I'll come back to it. Quick question before we move on to something else. Do you think, generally speaking, because in the work that I do, the issue of nature versus nurture comes up often, which frankly is a false dichotomy because most of what we are is really a mix of our nature and our nurture. But do you think overwhelmingly how funny you are is something that is innate, or do you think it's something that could be learned?
I honestly think it's innate. I do think that you're born with, you know, and I've seen people that have been trying, you know, when you first start out, you do open mic nights, which is where you go and you get 3 minutes here, 3 minutes there. A bunch of you line up for like 5 hours just for a few minutes of stage time. There's people that I saw when I first started out, we'd be lining up together, and then 10 years later, I see them again, and they still haven't figured out the rhythm. They still don't have a likability on stage. There's a lot. I mean, because the other thing is, there's people that are very funny off stage, great joke tellers.
Right.
But they would not be good comedians, because to be a good comedian, there needs to be some level of confidence to stand on that stage in front of people. There also needs to be some opinion and originality, because you can be a good joke teller at parties, but if you don't really have an opinion on things, then it's hard to go on stage and stand out and say, oh, that's that guy's style and opinion. So I do believe it's nature. I think nurture can help. Probably, you know, you hear a lot of people say, I became funny because my dad was funny. I became funny because we were always practical joking around the house or whatever. So that kind of stuff, I think, does help. Like, I've never been a practical joker.
Right.
I know there's some people that love practical joking, and a lot of times that does come from being kids at the house and the dad would put a whoopee cushion under you or whatever. My dad never put whoopee cushions under me.
You mean that's not what he did after escaping the Iranian Revolution?
No whoopee cushions,
no
man.
No whoopee cushions. Now, Christopher, do you know who Christopher Hitchens is?
Yeah.
No, yeah, so he passed away a few years ago. He was a very strong voice of sort of reason and all sorts of social commentary. At one point, I think he had remarked, and he had gotten a lot of blowback from sort of the politically correct crowd, about the idea that sex differences in humor, and the idea that there are very clear reasons, as he suggested, and there are also evolutionary reasons that one can propose as to why, on average, you know, most of the top comedians tend to be men, with a few exceptions, and the female comedians that are successful have a certain characteristic. what are your views on that? Do you buy it from a practitioner of the field or not?
No, I haven't thought as much about it. I know that, you know, numerically speaking, there's probably more male comedians than there are female comedians. There's probably more successful male comedians than there are successful female comedians. I don't know what the reason there is. Because I know there's some female comedians that I've watched and I'm like, oh wow, she's hilarious.
Right.
And you were saying there's some characteristics, meaning like maybe they're more masculine. But
bingo.
Yeah, but you know, I've also seen some that aren't as masculine that are very funny. So I honestly don't know what the cause is. It's actually funny. I'll tell you something. A conversation I had with a friend of mine recently. I went skiing this past weekend, and we were talking about how as you ski around, you don't see that many African Americans, you know, that many black people on the slopes. And my friend, who is a fiscal conservative, his thought was, his theory was that that's because African Americans, they excel in basketball and football and some other sports. So that so a lot of African American families, he was saying, will gravitate towards those sports as opposed to going towards skiing.
Right.
And my argument, and my argument, my wife's argument, and his wife's argument were, no, that's not why. It's because it's an expensive sport, and culturally speaking, the African American community hasn't been as well off as some other communities that would afford these lessons, and therefore, you know, you don't see as many, and you're starting to see more, especially in Northern California, where you have Silicon Valley, you have successful African Americans. But that's my thought was, well, that's the reason is it was a financial thing. Now let's go to the female side,
right.
And I wonder if the reason why you see fewer strong female comedians might be because, just culturally speaking, guys were expected to do the practical joking and pulling down the pants and farting and as kids, just being crude and trying to be funny. And girls, maybe the role of a girl had not been thought of as that until the past 30, 40 years.
But even if I could interject, but yeah. even if it is a sort of socialization, role-based explanation, then the question that begs asking is, to the extent that these gender-specific roles are pretty universal, then they must be speaking to an underlying biological truth. In other words, it would be coincidental that every single society that's ever been documented, men somehow end up being on average funnier than women, and it's just by fluke that in every one of those cultures, it's due to arbitrary gender roles. You see what I mean? So even if we buy your postulate of a gender role, we still need to know why that is the case, right?
Well, yeah, but I think the thing to look at is if you look at America over the past 30, 40 years, or the West for the past 30, 40 years, where women have been more and more liberated, more and more encouraged to speak out. Like a lot of women that I see, female comedians, a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them I've seen will get very sexual and very dirty
right
away. And it's almost like they have to go there to prove that, hey, I'm going to be in your face. You better be ready for this.
Right.
So it's almost like we've said to women, listen, go for it. We're empowering you.
Right.
Go for it. And they've gone for it.
And there is a woman that recently, I don't know her, I don't remember her name, that had a movie. She's a famous...
Amy Schumer.
Exactly. Yeah. I actually saw, I was on a flight. We went on vacation just recently for 2 weeks. And either on the flight there or back, I can't remember, I watched her one-hour HBO thing. And she certainly was a lot more raw than you would typically expect of a female comic. So that speaks to your point, yeah.
Yeah, and I think like if you look at that, I think that you see that women over the past 34 years have been encouraged to do that in the West. Now, you go to other places, and they still are not encouraged to speak out in that fashion.
Right.
I mean, even just comedy in general, a lot of other places, it's fledgling. In the Middle East, it's new, it's young, and you will not get, you don't even see that many funny male comedians because it's newer. So I know what you're saying because, like, for example, if you took basketball, for example, and you put the best men's basketball team versus the best women's basketball team, well, the best men's basketball team is going to win. They're bigger, they're stronger, they're faster. That's just natural. So I don't know if you could, you know, the unfortunate thing about comedy, going back to how it's subjective, it's not like a basketball game where you can end up and go, well, these, you know, the men scored 100 points, the women scored 98, therefore the men are funnier.
Right.
I don't know. So the fact is, it's hard to compare it in that way, and I don't know what the numbers are of successful and funny female comedians going through, but I do know I'm seeing a lot where I've sat back, you know, because my instinct, like what you were saying, my instinct when I first started out was to look around and go, the girls, there's less of them, and there's a couple that I don't really get, and I don't think she's that funny. But then as I've watched, like objectively sat in the back of the room and watched, and watched like a Sarah Silverman, or a...
she's good.
Yeah, there's a Natasha Leggero, there's a Eliza Schlesinger. These are all young comedians that I know. Tammy Pescatelli. There's all these female comedians I've sat in the back and been like, oh man, she's killing it.
Right.
And those are all Whitney Cummings. These are all...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, these are all like more feminine comedians that are killing it. So as I'm seeing that, I'm thinking maybe they're being more and more encouraged to get into this field. I mean, you could also make that same argument about why aren't there that many Middle Eastern comedians, or why aren't there that many German comedians? Like, this cultures that culturally speaking are not known for comedy, but then once we start looking at the cultures, we see, for example, I'm sure in Iran, sense of humor is huge, right. But Americans don't know that. And then the reason why there's not that many Middle Eastern comedians in America is because we're recent immigrants to this culture. So I think there's something to that. But you also may have a point as to maybe, like you were saying, that Hitchens had said, maybe there's something to men on the average have that gene or have that whatever to make them be prone to comedy and being good at it more than women. I'm not sure, but maybe there's something there.
Right. Well, to talk about the cross-cultural angle, this is a working hypothesis that I thought of as you were speaking about, you know, Lebanon or Iran. I wonder, and this is a postulate, so I'm not sure, I wonder if the reason why there isn't as big a tradition of sort of stand-up comedy in those societies is because of the predominance of, you know, the ethos of culture of honor and shame, which I've talked about in the past, right? I mean, part of, you know, humor is to make fun of something, right? I mean, you're making fun of a particular race, or you're making fun of men or women, or you, right? So it involves making fun, hopefully in an innocent, non-hurtful manner, but you're making fun of somebody. And in a culture, in cultures that are very austere, where you should never lose face, where you should, then that is something that's not permitted, right? I mean, Ayatollah Khomeini had said, I mean, if I could link it to something like, you know, there is no fun in Islam. There is, right? I mean, austere. That's shameful. So do you think that could be a reason why there isn't this tradition of stand-up comedy in these cultures?
Yeah, I think there's that. But I also think, because here's the thing, is like, I know at least in the Iranian culture, and I'm sure that Lebanese have a similar thing, a lot of these countries, I know that when you would go to a party or something, constantly the men would find a corner and then joking would just start, joke after joke after joke, and it's just on and on and on. So it's like almost like behind closed doors is fine,
right?
But the difference,
just don't do the performance.
Don't do this performance. Yeah. Don't do it to people that you're supposed to respect. There's this culture of a patriarchal culture. So you're supposed to respect your father. You're supposed to respect your elders. And by projection, then you're supposed to also respect your leaders.
Yes.
So that's why I always say that the difficulty of stand-up comedy in the Middle East is a lot of the promoters are very aware, and they're very wary of the comedians doing any jokes about the leadership. Like, do not talk about the king or the sheikh or the whatever it is, don't talk about that guy at all, because that's bad. Now, the reason why stand-up is able to flourish in the West is you're encouraged to. In these countries, I always say in America, they have an annual event where they get the president and they roast him.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? The correspondence dinner.
Yeah.
Whereas in any of these other countries, you even mention the name and you better be saying thank you to the sheikh for allowing us to have the show today.
Right.
Right? So I think that culturally speaking, that respect, whereas the West says question authority and these other countries say, hey, he's the divine man, you know, the Khamenei, who is right. now the supreme leader, he's divine. You cannot make fun of him. Nobody sits there and goes, wait a minute, that guy puts on pants like me. He just read a book a little bit more than I did.
Right.
What the hell? What makes him the guy?
And that's literally true. It's one or two or three books. That's all.
That's it. And so I think that's one of the reasons why it holds the society back a little bit or a lot in terms of pushing that envelope and holding the leaders to a certain standard. So then it also makes it so that, I mean, I've even done shows, you know, in English, we don't have the formal you
yes.
and the casual you. In Persian, we have, or Farsi, we have the formal you and the casual you. And it's interesting because I've done shows before where there's been either some Iranians or even some Arabs that are a little bit older, or they're newer to America where I'm doing a show. And I can see that sometimes they seem a little bit uncomfortable about some of the language that I'm using or some of the things that I'm saying. I can see it. And I want to tell them, hey, man, relax. You know, I intentionally, when I speak with other Iranians, I grew up in such a culture of like respect your elders, respect your elders, where comedy helped me get over that.
Right.
I remember specifically being on stage at the Comedy Store one night, and one of my friend's mothers had come to see the show with her friend, and I was doing my act, and I think I cussed. And right after I cussed, I was like, oh my God, I said it out loud. I go, I just realized my friend's mom is here. And I said, I'm so sorry, ma'am, I didn't mean to do that. But then it was so freeing to do that because she was laughing. And I realized, wait a minute, she knows these words. We all know these words. So now a lot of times when I speak to other Iranians, I used to use the formal you whenever I would address other Iranians I just met. I try to break that ice
right.
faster and go right to the casual you because I want to make it so that, hey, let's screw all these formalities. Let's right. talk, you know?
Two quick things about the formal address versus the informal one. In French, you have tu and vous.
Yeah.
And when you don't know someone well or their higher status or older, you address them as vous. Now, what's interesting is that that is a convention that is part of classical French. So if you were in France, or let's say I'm from Lebanon, which was at one point under, you know, a French protectorate, then that's how we were brought up. When you come to Quebec, where I currently reside, where they also speak French, where it's a lot more egalitarian, there is no tu vous. So even though it's in French, that has been, if you like, suppressed. And therefore you have 10-year-olds who are addressing a 60-year-old with tu. And I remember that when we first moved to Canada, my parents took them a long time to accept that because it was incredibly impolite. So that's so number one. The second thing, I don't know why I'm pulling blanks. I want to tell you something else. Keep going. And I said, oh, as he's speaking, I thought of something. But all right, let's go ahead.
Well, what you say is great because it's interesting because it's amazing how offended some people that come from that older culture
right.
will be at that.
Right.
And one of the things that's interesting to me is my kids now, 7-year-old and almost 5, when they address the parents of the other kids, they would call them Gad or they would
yes.
call them Mike or Tom.
What's your feeling about that?
Yeah. You know, I'm okay with that. Like they call their teachers Mr. This,
yeah,
Mrs.
Yeah.
That. I personally, again, it goes back to what it was. Like as a kid,
yeah.
I was so afraid of adults. I was so afraid of authority.
Right.
I remember I would go to these movies. There was a movie theater near our house. I would go to the movie theater, and the guy who was the manager who would always have like an earpiece or like a walkie-talkie and like have a blazer on, I was always so scared of those guys. Because I was like, oh my God, I better make sure I have the right ticket.
Right.
I want to make sure I can't have a PG ticket and go to an R movie or something.
Right.
Whereas I know people – they were a lot more relaxed about like, they were like, hey, you buy a ticket to PG, go see your R movie. Or I had a friend of mine was telling me that his friend's dad, who was a successful doctor, just as a practice, he used to go buy tickets for his kids and he'd say, I'll meet you inside. And he just wanted to prove that he could do this. He would walk without a ticket. He wouldn't buy himself a ticket. He just would walk past them with such confidence that they felt like, oh, he's here. He must have a ticket.
Right.
He would do it as an exercise. And then you only later do you grow up and realize that guy who was in the jacket and the walkie-talkie is some poor employee who's getting paid like $5 an hour.
Right.
Who might be a meth addict.
Right.
You know, who you don't know. But the fear that's instilled in you when you got to go, Mr. This, Mr. That, hello, may I, can I? Which there's something, you know, listen, don't get me wrong. There's something good to having that fear and discipline in your parents and all that stuff and some of the elders. So like, whereas my kids call the other parents Tom and Mike and whatever, if they, for any reason, say anything disrespectful, instantly, my poor daughter recently, I felt so bad. She's not even 5 yet, and she doesn't understand the world as an adult would, obviously. And so we had this tiny, I think it was the tiny foosball table. It was kind of broken down in the sort. I was going to throw it out, and then I was like, maybe our cleaning lady will want this. And our cleaning lady is like a maybe 60-year-old Mexican lady. I go, maybe the cleaning lady. So I started to kind of take it to put it for her, and my daughter goes, why would a cleaning lady want a foosball table? Or the way she said it, it just sounded very disrespectful.
Right.
Now I realized because I was on her like that. I was like, hey, I go, don't you ever talk like that. You know, I was like, you know, you be respectful of her and da 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 da. And then I only later did I realize a poor girl.
She didn't know any better, yeah.
No, but she was saying, like, what does a 60-year-old woman want a foosball table?
But that's ageist. That's ageist. Speaking of which, finish your point. I remembered what I wanted to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that I was like, I have a zero tolerance for disrespect.
Sure.
But if it's calling them Tim and Mike and stuff, I'm okay with that. But if they, for whatever reason, if they're disrespectful, I mean, we're done.
I hear you. Three more things. I remember the thing that I forgot. Earlier, we were talking about sort of the freeing environment in the West to do stand-up comedy versus the more difficult environment, say, in the Middle East. But of course, some shackles are now creeping into the West when it comes to comedy. So the joke that I just did about ageism is the typical thing sort of that the social justice warrior would do. So where you have the thought police and the perpetually offended and the perpetual victims on campuses who cannot hear any joke lest somebody might be offended and they have to go to a safe space. And as you probably know, a bunch of very famous comedians, including Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock, have said they no longer play on campus. What's your views on that? Do you share their views that you shouldn't be on campus? Or so, what do you think?
It's, you know, it's so ridiculous. I mean, the unfortunate thing is that the world of social media has made it with comedy, as well as I was thinking with any kind of any event that happens. I mean, the opinions that come out, like they arrest somebody and right away everyone's going, he's guilty, guilty, guilty.
Right.
And it's like, wait a minute, I thought you're innocent until proven guilty.
Right.
And the unfortunate thing is that people just, you know, build on top of it and it blows up to this big mountain.
And does the fact that that reality exists cause you to be more careful? Never mind in terms of whether it still makes you interested in appearing on campuses. Are you more self-censoring? Because what if I say this, somebody will be offended, whereas five years ago you didn't do that?
Yes, slightly, slightly. Okay. Mostly when it comes to posting something on social media. So if I'm sitting there, there's been times where I've posted something and the reaction it gets and the misinterpretation it gets.
Right.
Because, you know, if I write some words, you know, if I say, for example, like if I said to you, like, yeah, don't be stupid, right? Now you understood the way I just said that. I'm joking. I'm smiling, right? But if I say, Gad, don't be stupid, and I sent and I hit send, someone's going like, oh my God, you just called Gad stupid. Like, why would you? So so realizing that sometimes, not so much thinking like, oh wow, my career is going to be over, but rather like, oh man, now I got to deal with a bunch of bozos who are going to misinterpret what I said. So more on social media, I think. Sometimes when I'm posting something, I'll reread it or reword it to make sure that it reads right so it's not going to be misinterpreted. And then if it still gets misinterpreted, I go, okay, this person out of the 100 people, the 5 comments I got that didn't get it, you know what? There's nothing I can do to change those people. And I have no idea how crazy these people might be.
Right.
And so when it comes to comedy, I honestly don't have – I try not to hold back. I mean, I think that – You gotta say what you want to say. If you find it funny, you find it funny. If the audience laughs, then they laugh. If not, you know, I'm working on this new bit, for example, and I don't know if it's gonna work or not. I've tried it a few times. It's gotten some chuckles. I'm not sure. I can feel people are uncomfortable when I do it. But I was working on this bit about how I support immigrants, and I myself am an immigrant. And I said, furthermore, I support immigrants now because even more than ever, because I'm a comedian. And I don't have a day job, so I really don't keep track of the days. And I go, it's only because of immigrants that I know what day it is. So I go, for example, I know Monday is when the Mexican cleaning lady shows up. Wednesday is the Guatemalan gardener. Friday is the Armenian car wash guy, and Saturday is my Iranian drug dealer.
What happened to Tuesday and Thursday?
Well, I just make I don't know. But the point was, this all came to me because I said, if they deport these guys, I'm going to miss all my meetings. You'll say, why? You know, you missed the meeting. I go, yeah, because they sent Jorge back to Mexico. You know, like, now, here's the thing. Now, first of all, the honest truth of where this even came to me was, in all honesty, I woke up one day and I was going, what day is it? And then I think I heard the leaf blowers and I was like, oh, it's Wednesday. The gardeners are here. Now, as racist as that might sound, it was the truth.
Right.
And so the first time I did the joke, I talked about how it is. On Mondays, we have a cleaning lady whom I love. I just spoke about her.
Yeah.
She's Mexican. And then on Wednesday, we've got the gardeners who, I don't know if they're Mexican or Guatemalan. I don't know them that well.
Oh, the fact that you can't tell the difference suggests that you are a Nazi, man. You are racist.
Well, I think they're Mexican, but for the case of this joke, I made them Guatemalan.
Fair enough.
But the point I'm trying to make to you is, the first time I tried the joke, I said, you know, they helped me figure out the days of the week. Monday is my cleaning lady. Wednesday is my, actually, I said Mexican cleaning lady. And then I said Wednesday, I think the first time I did it, I said Wednesday is the Mexican gardener. And I left it at that because that was the reality of it. And I could feel that the audience was, I don't know. And then a friend of mine who's another comedian was like, hey, you should add a couple more and mix the races up so people are a little more comfortable. And I said, okay, I'll throw in an Armenian car wash guy, which, by the way, I don't get a car wash every Friday.
Hey, my wife is Lebanese Armenian. Be careful.
There you go. And then I said, you know, I said on Saturdays I got to get the drug dealer, and I've messed with the drug dealer. The first time I called them Canadian, then I called them Moroccan, then I tried Iranian. So I don't even know if this joke's gonna work or not. I found it funny,
right. But
I don't know if people either don't find it funny or they're sensitive to it. So, you know, but end of the day, the point is you got to throw it out. And if they don't laugh, if you try it 3 or 4 times and they don't laugh, then you go, okay, it's just not going to work, or I got to rework it, you know. But I hope we don't hold back too much with the PC stuff.
Good. Two more. I know you're short on time, but do we still have a few more minutes?
8 more minutes. 7 minutes.
7. Boy, you've got me on a tight clock. Okay, two quick things. Let's see if we can fit them both in. I'll tell you about them, and then you can comment on each. Number one, I know that you are working on a new show that you're pitching, which, by the way, you had told me that I would have a major role in. So you must publicly now proclaim that I'm going to be in that role. And you must incorporate the following line somewhere for my character. I look to the woman and I say, that dress is not going to come off by itself. You have to say that.
That's it. That's done.
That's done. All right. So you can talk about that. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about, I don't know if we can do all that in 7 minutes, so maybe you pick which one you want to cover. Some of the folks that you hang around with, I may not appreciate them as much, like Cenk Uygur, like Reza Aslan, like Dean Abdullah, for very specific reasons. So I don't know if we have time to get into that. Do you want to just cover the TV show today and end it there, or it's up to you?
Whatever you want. Throw it at me and we'll go.
Well, okay, so let's do the second one then. So I know that you and I, when we were in Mexico, we briefly talked about Reza Aslan because I know he's a friend of yours. I've frankly gone after him a few times because I thought that in the same way that you rightly criticize, the sort of the hick who thinks that all Muslims are terrorists and he's a buffoon. On the other end of the spectrum is somebody who I call a member of the ostrich brigade, right? Somebody who puts their head in the sand and who it doesn't matter which data I can present this person. He is always in unicorn land with his apologetics, right? And regrettably, from my perspective, I say regrettably because I know he's a friend of yours, so I want to be diplomatic.
Sure.
And from my perspective, Reza and Cenk and to some extent Dean are succumbing to that. I'm sure they're lovely people personally, as interpersonal, friends, but that's the feeling that I get, and that's why I sort of criticize them. What's your take on what I just said, and where am I wrong?
Listen, first of all three of those guys I know, and I find to be great guys, and I do know that you know as well as I do that when you get into war statistics, there's always like, you throw one number out, I throw another number out. You throw one number, and we're back and forth. I think that what they do, when it comes to things like Muslims in America or terrorism and things like that, I think it's such an uphill battle right now. And I really, just as a human being, what shocks me is how quickly people that have been persecuted will jump on the bandwagon and go, screw those guys. Right. There was a great piece on NPR where this Indian Sikh was talking about how he would walk down the streets of New York, and this guy's very American, he walked down the streets of New York, and he said, wearing the turban, he said he was getting comments, like, go back to your country, and he goes, now, this is, a study wasn't done, but he's talking about his experience. He goes, the people that were yelling that most to him were blacks and Latinos.
Right.
He said, I was getting it most from blacks and Latinos. And so it blows my mind when that happens. Now, these guys like Cenk and Reza and Dean, I'm not sure which specific instance you're talking about, but for example, when a thing does happen where there's a terrorist attack or a Muslim does something, it's the proportion of the amount of media, the amount of vitriol that is thrown at the community. I mean, you got to look at a guy like, Trump, and I keep saying, I'm not scared of Donald Trump himself. I feel like if I sat down with Donald Trump, I know that he's a smart guy. I know that if I sat across from him at a dinner and he started saying some of his ideas and opinions, I could be like, man, you're crazy. Pass the wine. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm cool with that because he's this guy who is one guy, and I know he's got his opinions, but he's a smart guy. What scares me are the followers. And you start seeing these people that have been looking for almost a messiah to come out and say these things. You see a video of, I don't know if you saw this video, but at one of his recent rallies, some guy, I think he was there.
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, where he's like, Black Lives Matter or something. He was yelling something, protester, they're pulling him out. And as they're filming it, you hear in the background, someone goes, light him up, a black guy. They say, light him up. And I'm like, whoa, that's scary. Right. And you keep running into these guys. So the thing that these guys like Reza and Cenk and Dean do when they jump out and they try to defend Muslims or what have you, I feel like is such an uphill battle that now I don't listen. You might know better than I do, statistically speaking. Right. If they're throwing out a lot of fake statistics, then that's an issue that they should be held accountable for. But I feel like voices like that are needed in this in this culture that we're in right now, because it's really people get irrational, and you need to have people like them come out and go, wait a minute, man, look at the numbers. Like, look at the whatever the thing is, the billion Muslims in the world and the small percentage that are doing this, and let's separate them and let's say, let's all together, focus our energy towards these people and find a way not to discriminate against the other. Because in all honesty, as these terror groups want us to discriminate against all, because then that's a very easy way to
narrative to
go, look, it is a war against the East and the West.
I guess I know we'll wrap it up soon. I guess my issue with some of these guys is that they constantly conflate criticism of an ideology with criticism of individuals. And irrespective of the number of times that you make the point. So, for example, I could criticize something in Judaism where I say, look, there is a prayer in Judaism that says, thank you, God, for not making me a woman, right? Well, I could say that passage sucks. It's misogynistic. It's sexist. I don't like it. And the fact that I just said that about a passage in Judaism doesn't make me anti-Semitic. It doesn't make me a member of the KKK. It doesn't make me a neo-Nazi. So by the same token, we could look at certain realities, whether they be statistical realities, whether they be geopolitical realities, whether they be passages in the Quran or the Hadith or the Sirah, and say, this passage really sucks. And my saying that, and that leads to violence, doesn't mean that I'm condemning Maz Jobrani, who has nothing to do with that bullshit. So right. I think that's what I don't like about them, is that they're so, I think probably their heart is in the right place, right? They really want to make sure to do all the things that you said. But you also have to be intellectually honest. So for example, when these guys have the reflex to go after every single person who criticizes Islam as a racist and a bigot, when some of these guys who are criticizing Islam are some of the most liberal people you could think of, that's not cool. So,
I just think, I mean, listen, I think that the problem is, I haven't seen all of their appearances to say, maybe there has been time. I'm sure there's been times where if you question Reza, let's say, or in an interview, and you said, are there passages in the Quran that are racist or you know, homophobic or whatever, or I should say, you know, that are violent, I'm sure he would say, yes, there are. I mean, but I think the problem is, no, I think I've had conversations with him about that, as well as Cenk, and I'm sure I've talked to Dean about it, but I think that they understand that. I think the problem becomes, and you know, I've experienced this a little bit. Recently, I was on a couple of, I did Dr. Drew's show on Headline News, where they were talking about the Trump statement, let's keep Muslims out. Right. And I kept trying to bring up the fact that most of the Muslims I've met, and all the Muslims I've met, none of them have been terrorists. Most of them are good people living their lives. And I said, as a matter of fact, I said, a lot of Muslims that are very religious probably have more in common with Christians than you would think, because they're all conservative. Like, you know, they're all homophobic. They're all, you know, you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of things that they have in common.
United in our hatred.
They're united in their hatred. But the point I was trying to make was the difficulty becomes, again, Gad, we got to look at the environment that we're in. So some of these guys who criticize the Islam, they go, Islam says this, that, and the other that's violent. And then these terrorists are taking that idea and they're turning it into a call to jihad.
Right.
I think the problem becomes, listen, when I was on those panels, the tweets I was getting from people, they weren't listening to what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say there's a world of grays and they're living in their black and white.
Right.
And so they would tweet me and say, you know, Jesus is the right way. Why are you being an apologist for the Muslims? And, blah, blah. And I said, look, I'm not even religious. I in all honesty, I could care less. If anybody should hate Islam, it should be me, because I came from a country, my life was turned upside down because of the Islamic revolution.
Right.
And yet I do see these people that I meet, and they're good people, and the fact that they get discriminated against. When I hear about a girl wearing a hijab and trying to drive and having people cut her off and honk at her and tell her to go back to her country, I go, man, we're in this, it's a very sensitive time. Right. So I feel like what these guys are doing, whether it's Reza or Cenk or Dean, is necessary to push back a little bit and go, listen, guys, if we're going to have a discussion, let's really keep it in the gray zone and say, yes, there are passages that are violent. And yes, the terrorists do use these passages to convert people to their cause. But just because those passages are in the Quran doesn't mean that the guy down the street who's a Muslim is, you know, still believes that if his son is caught in a homosexual act, that he should be executed.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I'm just saying that I think there was such a sensitive time. These voices are needed. As much as it might irritate you, I do feel it.
So basically, in conclusion, what you're saying is that the ends justify the means. You know, the fact that they're, from your perspective, that their heart is in the right place, that they're trying to protect people from bigotry, That's what sort of gives them the reflex to always sort of come on the defensive. And I can appreciate that. And hopefully another time we'll continue to talk about this. I'm only ending it because you have to go, buddy.
Okay, you're right.
Because I could keep you here for another 3 hours.
No, we'll pick up again another time.
This was fantastic, man. I'm coming to California in February, so clear the streets, hide the women. The Godfather, last week of February, will be in SoCal. I'll be doing the Dave Rubin Report, and I'll be on Joe Rogan again. So hopefully you and I can catch up there in person. It was such a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this, Maz.
Thanks for having me, man. And this dress does not come off by itself.
I'm going to stop it, but then stay on the line for a second, all right?
All right.
Cheers.